From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Friday the 13th, 2019. This weekend at the Riverside, the Milwaukee Symphony is showing Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire and providing the live soundtrack, and that's a really good time. And it's a Motown Christmas with the Temptations and the Miracles next Friday at the Riverside. The Bucks have three home games this week, and it's Bear Week. The Packers host the Bears this Sunday. Supposedly, everything is bigger in Texas and more expensive, too. A Houston restaurant is selling a $1 million fajita at the bargain price of $400. Fool me once, et cetera, et cetera. And speaking of Texas, the partial southern border wall seems to be working. The Border Patrol seized 154 pounds of bologna from being smuggled into El Paso. Now we can all sleep better tonight. And I hope you're sitting down for this bit of news. In spite of their different colors, nutritionists have determined that all Kellogg's Fruit Loops taste the same. I feel so used. In the studio today, we have Kyle Titting, Steve Giles, Tom Papenfuss, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
You mean it's not fruit? Well, folks, markets eked out meager gains this week. NASDAQ climbing 0.9%, not too bad, rising 78 points to close at 8735. Meanwhile, in the broader markets, the S&P stock composite 500 rose 0.7% the week, 23-point advance, and closing at 31.69. Pretty good recovery later in the week after the early week sell-off. Dow Jones Industrial Average added 120 points this week, rising 0.4%. We close at the bell this afternoon in New York, with the Dow finishing the week at 28,136. NASDAQ up a whopping 33% this year. S&P up 29%. Dow up 23.5%. You know, Kyle, we started off the week on a negative tone. Data released late Sunday showed sharp decline in Chinese exports to the United States, down a whopping 23%. Market went down 100 points. Federal Reserve, as you know, met on Wednesday, decided to keep interest rates unchanged. And the talk now is that interest rates aren't going to be changed through next year. And so I think that set the way for a nice market rebound on Thursday, along with news that maybe they're going to get somewhere, at least for the first round, with the U.S. on China trade agreements. But it doesn't appear that they've accomplished a whole lot other than deciding to keep talking. So I think all in all, against that backdrop, you know, bad start at the beginning of the week, and then 220 point rally on Thursday that topped it off for me.
Yeah, I think, Bob, you point out all good points about how all year we've been climbing, you know, uncertainties. The market's risen in the face of tariff uncertainties. The market's risen in the face of uncertainties about what the Fed's going to do. And then I think, you know, we get some clarity this week, and it's not like the market just took off. On the other hand, it did recover nicely from an early sell-off in the week. And so I think, you know, some clear evidence, at least, that at least stock market participants are encouraged by the news. I think you mentioned the phase one trade agreement that's out there right now, still very early in the game, even for a deal that both sides say has been reached. You know, there's a lot that still has to happen before that passes. And so, you know, I think some optimism certainly about what that means for the future. But at the same time, I continue to be skeptical that, you know, it's going to be, to the extent that they say it's going to be, a good deal for both sides.
You know, after the Federal Reserve Board announced that they were leaving interest rates unchanged, they came out with the Consumer Price Index up 2.1% year over year through November, pretty low number. But what struck me, too, was that the unit labor cost revised sharply lower, which strongly suggests that wage growth is going to be modest here moving forward. So I'm trying to add all this up. The Fed's telling us they're not going to change interest rates through next year. Boy, that's a fair amount of clarity, right? And that inflation is barely measurable, and that unit labor costs are heading down And as a result, we shouldn't expect a whole lot of wage growth. So, Kyle, you know, we're removing some fairly big variables from the equation here.
You know, I think ultimately uncertainty is the thing that makes people nervous about investing in stocks. And if you can remove some of that uncertainty, that's a big deal. Obviously, you know, the Fed can be a tailwind to market returns, as can some clarity, on the employment market. Interesting that, for the better part of now maybe 5 or 6 years, the Fed had been saying, you know, we think we're reaching full employment, or we think we're at full employment, or we don't think the employment picture can get much better than it has. And lo and behold, the employment picture just continues to improve, even if slowly, even if wage gains haven't been there yet. And at some point in time, you'd expect that wage gains should come. But then you look at things like the prime age working population, right? The number of people or the percentage of people, 25 to 54, that are currently in the employment market. We've just now reclaimed the pre-recession peak for that age bracket. And certainly some demographics still, I think, pretty challenged there. And so even as we're, you know, well below 4% unemployment, I think there's room for improvement there. Signs that maybe the Fed's right in holding off for a year. Even after that year, they're only talking about maybe one or two increases in the overnight rate. And so, you know, for stock investors who are looking at, well, what would the alternative be? With rates as low as they are and for as long as we expect them to stay this low, you know, stocks continue to be a pretty attractive place to be.
Kyle, as you know, years ago, the Fed considered full employment to be 5%. So it's remarkable how wrong they were and how consistently wrong they've been, and that they keep lowering the bar for what is a full employment. And folks, what we're talking about here is the level of employment in the United States that won't trigger inflation. And for years, it was widely held that unemployment under 5% just isn't possible for this country. Because we're going to have to raise interest rates because inflation is going to percolate. So the Fed would aggressively raise rates when we got anywhere close to 5. And we've now turned that on its head. And I'm not even sure the government even gets a sense of what full employment is, because at 3.5, as you know, I mean, we're way below 5 and inflation is barely measurable. So I think we've got some room to run here on this front.
Certainly, Bob, one of the challenges has been participation, right? That we've talked in the past about how the number of people who should be participating in the workforce certainly aren't participating the way they used to. And so, you know, I think a lot of noise in that employment data as well. But as you rightfully point out, 3.5 is a far smaller number than 5. And so, you know, I think the Fed maybe is searching for some answers there.
I do think it's worth adding also that you can't have the interest rate conversation without also injecting earnings into the equation. If a Fed is going to keep interest rates where they are, all that does is lend support to the earnings yield, and we maintain a somewhat wide divergence between what is a quite favorable earnings yield, about 5.5%, relative to that 10-year Treasury number. Yes, valuations are somewhat overvalued relative to the 10 and 5-year numbers on our look back for earnings, but that spread is wide enough, Kyle, for us to have a degree of support for stocks moving into 2020.
And Steve, we've had pretty significant issuance of corporate debt in the past decade. As rates were very low, it was easy to finance corporate spending, easy to finance operations through debt. And so a big part of the earnings equation right now is that financing that debt was done so cheaply that it's easier to do it in the form of debt than it is in the form of equity issuance, which would hurt earnings per share. And servicing that debt has a far smaller impact on earnings than it otherwise would have. So not only is the earnings piece attractive relative to interest rates, low interest rates also help the earnings piece.
Tom, what's your take on current events?
Well, I think I was just going to add in with respect to rates remaining unchanged is when you look back through history and what the numbers show and statistics show is that when you look at different rate policies over time, that typically when rates are going up, it's usually, stock market performance hasn't been that good, because usually a sign of, well, they're trying to fight inflation and then perhaps a recession may be coming on. If they're lowering rates, it's obviously that they're not that optimistic about the forward path of the economy. But when rates remain the same, that's actually been one of the better signs for market growth in the future, is that, well, things look pretty good, and they don't really want to mess with it. So I think that's a kind of a nice positive takeaway from what's going on right now.
Well, to underscore that, look what the market did in the fourth quarter of last year, right? The Fed was determined to raise rates 4 times last year. market decided in the fall of 18, and stocks got creamed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until the Fed decided in January of this year, no, everybody misinterpreted our signals and we're not going to keep raising, we'll probably start lowering, that stocks stabilized. So, I mean, I see way more accidents when the Fed's tightening rates than when the Fed is lowering rates. And now they're telling us, pretty clear sailing through next year. Of course, they could interrupt that. But I agree with you, Tom. It's good for stocks.
Bob, one of the most interesting comments from the Fed was that the threshold for raising rates in the future is probably going to be far higher than it would be to lower rates in the future. And so getting to your point about how more damage can be done, or more damage historically has been done when we're raising rates, I think the Fed's starting to see that they need to raise the threshold a little bit for what inflation would be before they do raise them.
Joel, let's talk about some economic indicators that came out this week.
Sure, yeah. The biggest one was the one that came out today on retail sales. We talk about consumers and their spending, contributing 70% of the gross domestic product. And so that retail number every month is a good monthly gauge of how, what kind of an appetite consumers have. And unfortunately for November, it was a little modest. It was
soft in October.
Right, yeah. It was 0.4% in October, and it went down to 0.2% in November. That said, it's a short time period, and we know that holiday spending accounts for like a quarter of all of the retail sales in the year for U.S. companies. And those 2 months, October and November, although we think of the holiday season being at the end of the year, we know that people are spending more earlier in the year now than they used to for holiday spending. And it's still positive. I mean, that 0.4 in October, that 0.2 in November was still positive. One of the numbers that I looked at was the online sales. So that's up 11% from a year ago. So we're also seeing that whole shift in how people are shopping. And, you put that next to the number for department stores. And the sales for online sales surpassed department stores in 2002, I think it was. And ever since then, the online sales have just shot up. And I don't know many people that go to department stores any much anymore.
Well, they got to account for guys like Max, who has long told me that, Bob, real men shop Christmas Eve at Sears.
7-Eleven,
yeah. Okay, well, the government's going to have to tabulate your purchases here to give us a better picture. Joel, let's comment just briefly on some of the other economic reports that came out. Productivity declined more than expected. That's disappointing.
It is. That's, the one way we know that we can, build wealth in the country is when we're, getting more out of workers and the input is creating greater output. And this is the first time in 5 years, I'm sorry, 4 years, that that we've seen that slip. That in between the second and third quarter, we actually had a 0.2% decrease in productivity.
Well, I find it interesting, Joel, that, as I tried to teach everybody in September at the seminars, that there's only two components, as with GDP. And you have to add up the productivity gain, and to that, the increase in workers entering the workforce. And they think over the next 10 years, as you remember from the seminar, that the labor force is going to increase about 0.2%. And so I find it per year. And I find it remarkable that in what you released here on productivity, that year over year gain in productivity is 1.5%. And they think the increase in the workforce, give or take, about 0.2%. Right? So you add up 1.5, 0.2, you're at 1.7. And that's pretty much dead on where GDP is for the year. So for people that want to get their arms around, where's this economy headed over the next couple of years? all you got to do is add a productivity gain and the increase in the workforce. Now, that's pretty difficult to change the workforce increase, but productivity, you know, is, you remember in the 90s, it grew 2.5%, almost 3% a year for a while. So that's how you get to GDP north of 3%. But it'll be challenging to get it much past 2% here moving forward because of the anemic increases in output per man-hour work, productivity, and the 0.2% increase in the workforce.
And sometimes we don't know what kicks off productivity. Sometimes it's just sort of something magic. It could be artificial intelligence. It could be technologies we don't even know about yet that can all of a sudden, you know, make us more productive. So stay tuned for that.
You know, I want to spend just a moment acknowledging Paul Volcker's death on Monday, former head of the Fed, 92 years old when he passed. He was the head of the Fed from 1979 and 1987. And over the decades, I've tried to give him a fair amount of credit. You know, in so many speeches that I've given over the years, I talk about the famous quote of Ronald Reagan to Paul Volcker, "If not us, whom? And if not now, when?" And what the president was talking about is, you know, if we don't raise interest rates dramatically to choke off inflation, when are you going to do it? And if we don't take responsibility for it, who's going to do it? And, you know, a lot of people were upset at the time, but Paul Volcker saved the financial system. Pretty tough in the early 80s. Wisconsin got hit pretty good in that manufacturing slump. We had two back-to-back recessions. 80 recovered, and then to 81 had another recession. So pretty brutal, taking interest rates way up into the double digits. And the 70s were a remarkable decade because of inflation. The Arabs stuck it to us, quadrupled the price of oil. We had stagflation in the second half of the decade. Pretty tough, and inflation, you know, if you ever really want to truly worry about the stability of a financial system, worry when inflation takes off. Because once that little genie gets out of the bottle, it's tough to get it back in. And Paul Volcker recognized that. And, you know, good for him for doing that. And he had the good sense to resign as the Fed chair and hand the baton over to Alan Greenspan just before the crash in 87. Greenspan had been the head of the Fed just for a short period of time. Market drops 24%, 20 minutes. That was a pretty ugly day. But, you know, hats off to Paul Volcker for really reducing inflation, as painful as it got, because that gentleman should be credited with really helping to save the financial system after a period of time. Inflation was so high. And, you know, consider that inflation has been going down, give or take, almost every year since then. So we now can say, after all of these years, 40 years of experience, that inflation may have been the outlier in the 1960s and the 1970s. And for those of us that came of age then, you know, we know inflation. We can remember when things cost just a whole lot less than they cost now. But, you know, the high inflation, I think, knock on wood, is really something from the past. And because of globalization, something we may not have to deal with, at least for the handful of years into the future. Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the program. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.